You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new research shows Wisconsin lagging behind other states when it comes to new business development. We'll check out a new report that says part of the problem is that there aren't enough people moving into the state. First, the Americans with Disabilities Act will turn 30 years old next year. The ADA is seen as a major legislative accomplishment and a victory for civil rights for people with disabilities. But it's just one part of a decades-long struggle for equal rights and cultural acceptance, one that continues today. Our next guest has been on the forefront of the disability rights movement for many years. In a new memoir, she shares her story of getting involved and fighting for the cause. Nadina Laspina is a disability rights activist. Her new book is called Such a Pretty Girl, a story of struggle, empowerment, and disability pride. She joins us from Argo Studios in New York. Nadina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this title of your book, Such a Pretty Girl, this is something that you heard over and over again growing up in your native Sicily after having polio. How did this affect you? What was the meaning behind that statement when people said it?
Well, people never said, such a pretty girl. They said, such a pretty girl, what a shame. What a shame. So that made me feel that I was being pretty was a terrible thing, and that I was different from everybody else. So there was this very oppressive religious atmosphere. I went to my mother would take me to the across the street to the nuns, and what I grew up with was pity from everybody around me. And also the knowledge that that my life was going to be unhappy. I mean, that's what I got, the message I got.
Literally, that, one of the nuns told you, right? You will never be happy.
Literally, one of the nuns told me, yes. And that was my first act of rebellion when I said, absolutely not. I won't take this. I said, no, I will so be happy. And actually hit the nun with my fist, which is, I was lucky that she didn't take out the ruler. But yes, so that's how my story started in this little town in Sicily. And in the book, that's kind of the bad place where we can all find ourselves, so those of us who have disabilities, where you feel isolated. I didn't know anybody else, that I had no role models, where all you get is pity. And my father's belief that all he had to do was get me to America so I could be cured. And for him, of course, that was his way of expressing his love for me. He would have done anything. But what I heard was that I was not good the way I was, that I needed to be fixed, that my body was no good. And that reinforced this idea that, you know, I had no future to look forward to. He did manage then to bring me to the U.S. Together with Such a Pretty Girl. That was the one refrain. The other refrain was my father telling me, in America, cammini, in America, guarisci, which means in America, you're going to be cured. And when I came here, I was in the hospital having surgery after surgery after surgery, where they tried to get me to walk with braces and crutches. And the good thing about being in the hospital was that I was no longer isolated. I met so many disabled girls and boys, and they were like me. and I made a very, very close friend, the girl that became my best friend, unfortunately. She took those messages of doom a little too seriously. Well, you know, we all did. Those were the messages around us. All kind of internalized that negativity. The girl committed suicide, and it was after her suicide after I went through a really deep depression that I found the movement, and the movement was just starting, and I feel that it saved my life. We were just it was a time of movements. I mean, they were we were talking about rights. Everybody was talking about rights. Of course, the civil rights movement was the best possible example, and women's rights, and gay rights, and even animal rights. I mean, everybody. It was that time of great uprising, really. But I had never ever thought that as a disabled person I had rights. I thought that, you know, that was my problem, my tragedy. That's how they made me feel. It was disability was seen only as a medical problem and a tragedy. And it was only when we started getting together and comparing notes that we realized that it wasn't so much the disability that was making us so unhappy, but the way we were treated and the fact that we didn't have all the supports that we needed. And certainly we were living in a world that was never made for us. So the first fights, the first battles we fought were for access. I happen to be a wheelchair user, but of course there's whole types of access. But one of the first fights I remember being involved in was for transportation, because we couldn't, you know, we couldn't get out of the house. And even worse for some others who were stuck in institutions. But I was one of the privileged ones because I was able to drive. So I learned to drive early on. I could use my arms. I couldn't use my legs, but I could use my arms, and I drove with hand controls. And we were the privileged ones, the ones who could drive, because there was no way we could get on a bus or a train.
We're talking to Nadina Laspina, author of the new memoir, Such a Pretty Girl, A Story of Struggle, Empowerment, and Disability Pride. And Nadina, we look back from today to the Americans with Disabilities Act, to bus access, to the parking spots for people with disabilities. And it seems like, from hindsight, they just happened. You were there. They happened because you and others fought for them, right?
Right. People think that the change that they see happened because this is such a wonderful country and the government is so great that did all these things for us poor disabled people. But we had to fight for everything. To get those lifts on the buses, we literally went and got in front of the bus and said, if this bus if I cannot get on this bus is not moving, and people would get very angry. It's not like we had much support those days. Even today we don't have that much support. We had to fight for everything, every ramp, everything, the braille on the elevators, the sign language interpreters, whatever forms of access. It's been 50 years really, because I mean, they were the seeds were planted even earlier a little bit, but it really started in New York City. It started in I would say 1970 when a young woman named Judy Heumann decided to sue the Board of Education when she was denied a license to teach because she was a wheelchair user. She used the wheelchair, and she was seen as a fire hazard, and she was not, she couldn't teach. And she, instead of going home and crying her eyes out like the rest of us would have done, she sued the Board of Education and started Disabled in Action, which is the organization that's here in New York City. And I've been part of Disabled in Action for a very long time, since the beginning. And also then joined the organization ADAPT. ADAPT in 2017 had a lot of media attention when the ADAPT activists were dragged out of Congress and arrested, taken out of their wheelchairs, some of them, when fighting against the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. So those are two organizations that I was very, very involved with. But I am with ADAPT. I was ADAPT is one organization that really makes excellent use of civil disobedience. So I've been arrested. I can't tell you how many times I lost count at a certain point, certainly more than 50, maybe close to 100. I don't know. I was arrested very recently here in New York, but not for not a specific disability cause, but to in a demonstration against the detention centers. I do believe that the struggle of all oppressed people is a common struggle.
And Nadina,
interconnects.
We're just about out of time, and you tell a lot more stories in your book. But I wanted to ask you before we're done to that that statement from a nun early in your life: "You'll never be happy." Have you been happy?
I feel like I'm the luckiest woman in the world. I have lived a life that is continues to be so rich and so full of purpose. I believe purpose is very important in life. And I found the love of my life in the movement. We were together for 27 years. Unfortunately, he passed away 5 months ago. But we did a lot of work together, and we won many battles here in New York together. And I, even though I'm still very much, you know, I'm grieving his loss, I still can say I feel I am the luckiest woman in the world. So that nun, I certainly proved that nun wrong.
Nadina, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Nadina Laspina, disability rights activist. We've been talking about her new memoir. It's called Such a Pretty Girl, A Story of Struggle, Empowerment, and Disability Pride. Coming up, Wisconsin falls behind most other states when it comes to startup business creation. One possible obstacle: not many people move to the state from around the country or around the world. We'll check out a new report on the state's population and business growth. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Congress is back in session next week, and there's pressure on the Senate to take up gun reform legislation. We'll find out where things stand in our look at the week in national politics. First, small businesses are frequently described as the backbone of local, state, and even sometimes the national economies. And if small business development is a sign of a healthy economy, Wisconsin may be facing some problems. New research from the Kauffman Foundation finds that Wisconsin is lagging behind many other states when it comes to attracting new entrepreneurs who want to establish businesses. Our new guest recently co-wrote an article looking at this data for WisContext. Matt Curis is a community development specialist at the Center for Community and Economic Development at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Division of Extension. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll talk about the importance of these small businesses, startups, to, say, a state's economy.
Oftentimes, startups and small businesses are the backbone of job creation. And while most startups tend to be small, it really is the startup economy that is driving a lot of new jobs in our state.
So those already existing big companies, they're important to the job picture, of course, but maybe the percentage of new job creation might not be as high there.
That's great. And oftentimes we see in more established firms and in larger firms that they tend to be net losers of employment over time. They're still incredibly large employers in our economy, but oftentimes it is the small new businesses that are actually the net job creators in our state.
All right. Take us into this new national data that kind of compared state to state. What do we look like here in Wisconsin?
So there are a number of different measures that the Kauffman Foundation uses in assessing kind of startup activity in states across the country. They look at the rate of new business formation. They look at what are called opportunity businesses or new businesses. So businesses that are started because an entrepreneur saw a new market opportunity instead of starting a business out of economic necessity. They also look at firms that are growing in terms of employment as they're new, and then also the survival rate of new firms within the economy as well.
And then with all those things in mind, and I'm sure it wiggles around depending on which measure you're looking at, how do we look in Wisconsin versus some of the other states?
Kauffman has changed their methodology a little bit over time, but for the most part, the overall index shows Wisconsin being one of the lowest in terms of new startup activity among all states. And as you mentioned, some measures we do look a little bit better than others, but for the most part, we tend to rank fairly low in new business startups.
That takes us to this piece now you and your colleagues wrote at WisContext, looking at one possible cause of this, and it has to do with people moving out, people moving in, to quote the Temptations. What do we see there?
What we see is that Wisconsin tends to have a very high share of its population that was born here. So if you look at the share of residents that were also born in the state of Wisconsin, we have about 72% of our population that resides here that was also born here. And what that shows is over time, we have not been quite as dynamic in terms of people moving in the state and people moving out of the state. And oftentimes what that means is that we're not exposed to a lot of new ideas. We're not exposed to new ways of thinking. We're not exposed to new connections or networks that are created by people moving across state lines. And what that also means is that sometimes we are more resistant to creating new businesses because we do not have those new market opportunities identified by potential entrepreneurs that move here.
So the idea here is that if you have a lot of new people moving in, even if you have an outflow, if you have some people moving out, just that very churn of bringing new different people together in different ways creates a sort of, creative entrepreneurial energy?
That's correct. It's entrepreneurial culture, but it's also this idea of cross-cultural exchanges. So we see people that may have been born in the Northeast that moved to one place. They bring new ideas with them. People that were born in the Southwest that also moved to that place, they bring new ways of thinking with them. And as they interact with one another, they're able to identify new market opportunities for starting new businesses.
And you mentioned that statistic of the percentage of people in Wisconsin who were born in Wisconsin, 72%, I think you
said.
That's correct. And we're among the top five in the country in that, right? We're way up there.
We are way up there, and the upper Midwest in general tends to be way up there. So if we look at states like Illinois, like Michigan, they also tend to be highly ranked in the share of their population that was also born there.
Talking to Matt Curis from UW-Madison's Division of Extension, looking at startup businesses in Wisconsin. A report from the Kauffman Foundation says Wisconsin not real hot when it comes to new small business and entrepreneurship creation here. Part of the reason, Matt and his colleagues write in a new piece at wiscontext.org, maybe the population doesn't move around as much. We don't have people coming in from other states, other countries, creating new entrepreneurial ideas and enterprises. Matt, sometimes we've talked over the years about brain drain from Wisconsin, this idea that young people are maybe getting their college degrees and then leaving the state. That's not really what's happening, though, it looks like.
Well, we do see negative net migration in terms of people with college degrees and our entire population moving out of the state. So there are more people moving out than moving in. But one of the things we see that it's not so much that we're losing people on a net basis because everyone's moving out. It's more so that we're not bringing enough people from other places to offset that loss. So if we look at churn, which is a good way to put it, as you mentioned before, we have a very low rate of churn in terms of people moving out and moving in. So it's less of a brain drain and a lack of a brain gain.
So I wonder what we could do from a policy level if people agree that this is part of the problem here. We see the state had this marketing campaign, for example, trying to lure millennials from Grand Rapids, Dubuque, other small to mid-sized and larger Midwestern cities. I mean, can we do that? Can we just lure those people in by advertising to them?
I think it'll certainly intrigue some people's interest that may not have had a good idea of what Wisconsin has to offer. But really, a lot of these issues that we face in the state are somewhat structural in terms of how our economy is structured, in terms of the industries we have here, but also in terms of the different size cities we have here. So we do not tend to have a large dynamic metropolitan area like other states that are attracting a lot of people on a net basis. So Milwaukee is a large part of our economy, but it doesn't tend to have the population churn or attraction levels that, say, a Minneapolis, St. Paul, or a Denver, or Portland has.
Do communities like Milwaukee or does a state like Wisconsin have any control over its destiny when it comes to getting people into the state?
There are certainly some policy changes that could be made in terms of focusing on things like entrepreneurship. So how do we build that entrepreneurial culture that's going to make people want to come here because they know that they have a good chance of starting a new business and having it be successful? Also thinking about other ways to support diverse types of industries in our state that may induce people to move to Wisconsin more so than others.
Are there ways to take more advantage of the people who are already here, the 70-some percent of people who were born in Wisconsin and stayed in Wisconsin? Can we capture that lightning without, even if we can't get that population churn?
I certainly think so. I think as a culture in Wisconsin, me being one of the people that was born here and has stayed here for most of my life, there are opportunities to help better educate people about entrepreneurial opportunities, to help them be more supportive of entrepreneurs. So when a person does start a business and perhaps maybe fails in their venture, we're more supportive of that failure, and we learn from it, and we help them the next time they want to start a business rather than almost taking some perverse joy in the fact that they tried something and they failed.
That doesn't sound very Midwestern, that last way of thinking about it.
Well, if you think about it, because everyone's here, is from here, that lives here, we tend to not be very open to new ideas in some ways because we are very Midwestern, you know. So I think we're very nice on the surface to a lot of individuals, but there's also times that newcomers have a hard time kind of breaking into inner circles because they're not from here, because they haven't been here for generations, their parents weren't here, and so on and so forth.
What's the risk for people in Wisconsin and the economy of Wisconsin if we just keep moving in this current direction and staying one of the lower states in the country for entrepreneurial activity?
Well, I think it's going to be kind of the status quo then. You know, we've traditionally been a slower growing state in terms of population, businesses, and employment than a lot of other states. And if we continue down that path, we'll probably continue to see those slower rates of growth.
And what are you watching for next on this? Is there something that you're out watching for, whether it's policy or just demographics, to see if this is going to shift in one direction or another?
In terms of the indices that the Kauffman Foundation puts out, I'm curious to see the survival rates the next time the
businesses,
correct, the next time that they are published, to see if businesses that were started over the last year tend to stay in business, and also do they add employees. So a lot of times when we start new firms, it tends to be a sole proprietor or maybe one or two employees. But are these firms continuing to add employees going forward and grow their businesses?
All right, we'll leave it there. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Matt Kuras is a community development specialist at the Center for Community and Economic Development at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. He joins us today to talk about a recent piece he co-authored at WisContext that took a look at the impact people moving to or from the state has on new business development. I think that's up now at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, the United States Senate is under pressure to take up a background check bill for firearm purchases, but it's waiting to hear from President Trump about what he would actually sign if it came across his desk. We'll find out what we're likely to see as Congress reconvenes next week. That's part of our weekly roundup of the top stories in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we hear the results of the latest Marquette Law School poll released earlier this afternoon. First, we take a look at the week in Washington, checking in on the top news in national politics. Congress is coming back into session next week. The Senate is under pressure to vote on a background check bill and other gun reforms, while the House Speaker is weighing whether to take up a major new trade agreement. And the Trump administration is shifting more than $3.5 billion meant for military construction projects to a southern border wall. Our question for you this week, what do you think about this latest move to move this money to build a border wall? Do you think money is needed more in other parts of our immigration system? If you're a supporter of President Trump, how important is building a wall to you? And how do you feel about getting the money from, among other things, military projects? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill. Scott, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start in Congress. There's been some pressure on Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to take up a gun background check bill that passed the House. Here's some of what he had to say about that, talking during a radio interview this week.
If the president took a position on a bill so that we knew we would actually be making a law and not just having serial votes, I'd be happy to put it on the floor, and the administration is in the process of studying what they're prepared to support, if anything.
Now, President Trump has talked about different gun measures with mixed messages on some of them. What's happening here, Scott?
Well, to me, it seems like the president and Mitch McConnell are doing a bit of a dance here. McConnell says he's prepared to move forward on gun reform legislation if and only if Trump makes some sort of commitment to signing it into law. And so far, that hasn't happened. Trump continues to waffle on the background checks legislation. Some days he's for it. Other days he says, well, we already have plenty of gun laws in place. He's really been giving lawmakers on Capitol Hill and us in the press mixed signals. And his latest sort of iteration is he's saying, well, let's see what Senate negotiators come up with. He's sort of left it in the Senate negotiators' court. So both McConnell and Trump are sort of looking to the other guy for leadership on guns.
So this is kind of a go ask your mom, go ask your dad situation?
Yeah, it's really been quite bizarre and hard to follow and make sense of. I think we're going to have a better sense of the state of play and where things stand once Congress gets back into session next week.
House Democrats have passed some legislation that's not taken up in the Senate, right? What kind of things have we seen come out of the House?
Well, the big bill that came out of the House was H.R. 8, which is the background checks, universal background checks bill. In fact, that bill, you know, Democrats are saying could have prevented the latest shooting that we saw in Odessa and Midland, Texas, because that gun, as we understand it, was sold to the individual through a private gun sale. Under these universal background checks, you know, that loophole would be closed. And so Democrats are saying, you know, here is yet another example of lives lost because of inaction by Congress, specifically Mitch McConnell and the Republican-controlled Senate.
You recently wrote a piece on how this gun issue could shape the election next year, especially in suburban districts in the House. What kind of things are you seeing?
Well, that's exactly right. You know, talking to a lot of Republican lawmakers, they're explaining that Republicans really got clobbered in the suburbs in the 2018 midterms. That's a large part in why they lost the House, especially due to backlash to President Trump. And some of these Republicans that I'm speaking to have said that, you know, sort of what we saw from President Trump this summer, his erratic style of governing, his sort of flip-flopping on guns and the payroll tax and calling Jewish Democrats disloyal, the diplomatic row that we saw with Denmark's leader over her refusal to sell the United States Greenland, that's really cementing these feelings about Trump. So if you were opposed to Trump in 2018 and you're a voter in the suburbs, you're likely to be opposed to him in 2020, and that's made it very difficult for Republicans to make inroads in the suburbs heading into next year's election. You know, that has all sorts of implications, especially for the House, but also for the Senate and the White House. And I think that's why you're seeing some of these waves of GOP retirements, especially among House Republicans, including one today with Bill Flores of Texas, because of this sort of growing feeling that Republicans will not be able to win back the House and that life in the minority is not very fun.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories of the week in national politics. Scott, the Trump administration told Congress it's moving $3.6 billion meant for military construction projects to fund a border wall. Some news is coming out, I gather, about which projects that will be. But give us the backstory here. This is something the Trump administration had foreshadowed a while back.
That's right. President Trump made this announcement earlier this spring that he was declaring a national emergency on the border with Mexico. That enabled him, according to his staff and attorneys, to be able to shift previously allocated money from the Defense Department for military construction projects around the country to build the border wall on the southern border with Mexico. This list is, I think, about to become public, if it's not public already. But Defense Secretary Mark Esper has been calling lawmakers in recent days from states that will be losing funding. And so we know some of these projects. They include like a space control facility at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado, as well as I noticed a weapons training range in your state of Wisconsin. And so there are a lot of individuals, a lot of lawmakers and states impacted by this move. So far, the reaction has from Capitol Hill has not been great. The Utah senators, Republicans Mike Lee and Mitt Romney, said they were not happy that $54 million in projects would be delayed. And we have to remember these projects are not being canceled. They're just being delayed, but now they sit on a lengthy backlog list. And they've argued that this essentially gives the executive branch too much power and erodes Congress's power of the purse. But of course, this is Trump's, you know, one of his top priorities and pledges to his voters heading into the 2020 election was that he was going to build that wall, you know, that chant that we frequently hear at Trump rallies. And so, you know, he's under enormous pressure from his base. He needs them to turn out in the 2020 election, in the general election. And so in order to do that, he needs to energize his base. And one of the ways he sees he can do that is by beginning construction of his border wall.
But pulling money from military projects, and also we've seen in the news money coming out of FEMA and Homeland Security to do this, is there a risk that those choices are going to tick off as many people as it pleases, people who are happy to see the money going to the wall?
Yeah, I suppose that could be the case. And, you know, I'm sure in the days and weeks to come, we will see some polling as to whether this was a popular decision. But I think, you know, for right now, President Trump believes that that this is a good decision, a good political decision, and a strategic decision for him and his campaign heading into 2020.
And Democrats are going back to the president's or then candidate Donald Trump's campaign line, we're going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it. They're trying to remind the public that he didn't say that the Defense Department and the U.S. taxpayer is going to pay for it.
Right. And of course, you know, we are now, you know, nearly 4 years into the Trump presidency, and Democrats are trying to expose the fact that this has been an unfulfilled promise, and they're going to try to throw up all sorts of roadblocks that they can. I don't think they'll try to shut down the government over that. I don't think that would be productive, but clearly there are objections both from the Democratic side of the aisle and the Republican side.
Talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking into some of the week's top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We've been talking about the move from the Trump administration to take a couple billion dollars in military construction projects, put them on hold, and use the money for a border wall. What do you think of that idea? Do you think the money should stay in the military projects? Do you support President Trump's goal to build some kind of border wall? Should it be a priority? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Scott Wong. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill. We're looking at the week in national politics, some of the top stories in the national news. Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Ask for your thoughts on the rerouting of money from military construction projects and elsewhere to go into a southern border wall. Robert joins us now from Green Bay. Robert, hi.
Hi. I just want to say something about walls in general. You know, I'm not a big fan of wasting American dollars on a wall. I believe that as a sovereign nation, as anyone else, we should be able to seal off our borders and then maybe some kind of a, you know, make some kind of a immigration bill after, you know, a lot of this is a lot like the Flintstones where, you know, the cat's out on the front and he brings it out and it jumps back through the window. But the Maginot Line of France, the one in the East and West Germany, there's been a million walls through history. They don't work. You can fly over them. You can dig under them. You can go, if someone really wants to get here, then that wall, if the wall did work, which it won't because it's 4,000 miles long, you can, then people will try to funnel through Canada where there isn't a wall. It's like a big waste of time and money. And I think it's some kind of a campaign stunt that he just flapped off of his mouth saying he could do it. And, you know, kind of like what Kennedy did when he said, hey, we're going to go to the moon. They had no idea how to get there. We just got lucky enough to got some smart scientists that did it.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, a lot of people, I think, would agree with Robert about, you know, we could have more border security, but why a wall in particular?
Well, I do think there's some truth to Robert's point. I mean, the wall, you know, can be symbolic, right? The wall represents border security. The wall is something visual that a lot of voters can grasp the idea of. The immigration policy is much more difficult to talk about, to explain, and clearly to solve. And so I think the wall, in a lot of ways, and we've seen Trump go down to the border and take pictures and videos of the wall and in front of the wall, it can be a prop of sorts, but I think it also sort of represents something broader, which is, you know, border security and security of jobs for Trump and a lot of his voters.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. Well, I want to move on now, Scott. We talked about the Senate earlier. The House will be coming back, of course, and Speaker Nancy Pelosi has been under pressure to hold a vote on the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. That's the updated version of NAFTA. What is the status? What's the debate on that?
Well, it's in flux right now, and there's a lot of conversations happening. Pelosi herself had a conversation, a phone call with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada just yesterday. She's been telling anyone she can talk to, including Trudeau, about Democratic priorities that are not in the NAFTA 2.0 deal, including labor standards. She has concerns about high prescription drug prices, environmental protections. These are some of the things that they are still negotiating, and Democrats are still not happy that are not a part of this package. And so, you know, conversations are continuing. And again, just like the border wall, the USMCA or NAFTA 2.0 is a top priority for Trump and congressional Republicans heading into 2020. And they have, not a whole lot of wins or victories in this new Congress. And so they're looking for something tangible that they can point to as they run for reelection.
But some Republicans seem to be saying if Democrats don't pass something here, they can use this as a bludgeon in the election campaign.
I suppose that's correct. You know, voters want to see some kind of bipartisanship in action. And so far, this has been a Congress, you know, absent of any of that. And so I think both sides, that's correct. I think both sides are under pressure to show some kind of results, whether that's on gun reforms or on trade. Of course, this comes against the backdrop of America's big trade war with China that are creating jitters in the markets and the economy. And so I think voters are looking for some stability in the economy and as well as maybe some bipartisanship with trade.
Another issue in the House. Not too long ago, we reached a point where more than half of Democrats in the House supported starting impeachment proceedings of some sort. That's not enough to make it happen. What's the latest on this idea of either impeachment inquiries, impeachment hearings? I hear different phrases thrown around out there.
Yeah, you know, it seems like we hear an awful lot about impeachment, but, you know, I think the reality is that the magic number is 218 votes, and that's what Pelosi is looking for. That would be half of the entire U.S. House of Representatives, and so far we are far from that number. We're at about 120 or so. And so, you know, Nancy Pelosi knows she's a master vote counter. She knows where her votes are. And so far, you know, the overwhelming number of Democrats are, I would say there are a good number of Democrats that are not for impeachment. And even the ones that actually have said that they support an impeachment inquiry are not necessarily, you know, beating the door down, trying to impeach the president. So I think, you know, people are being very cautious about the language that they're using. They want to show their liberal base in their districts that they are hearing their concerns about President Trump, but also understand the political reality that, charging down this impeachment path could backfire for Democrats in the 2020 election.
And what else are you watching for as the House returns in the fall?
Well, you know, unfortunately, we're in a similar situation that we always are in with the possibility of a government shutdown on October 1st. Even though we have this two-year budget deal between Democrats and President Trump that was signed into law before the August recess, Congress still needs to pass their funding bills before October 1st. And so it looks like we're in exactly the same situation as we often are, where Congress will need to kick the can down the road and pass another continuing resolution or CR to keep the government's lights on into December, putting us in another precarious situation right before the holidays. So that's something that reporters on Capitol Hill are watching for.
Let's flip back over to the Senate now, Scott. Senate Majority Leader McConnell talked about the prospect of filling a Supreme Court vacancy in the next year and a half, the year plus leading up to a presidential election. That is something he refused to do in the year before President Obama left office. Merrick Garland didn't get any kind of a vote in that stretch of time. What is he saying now?
Well, McConnell is saying now that he absolutely would fill a Supreme Court vacancy either this year or in the presidential election year of 2020. There are, three of the justices are getting up there in years. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's been battling cancer on and off, is 86. Another liberal, Justice Breyer, is 81, and conservative Clarence Thomas is 71. So the possibility that something could open up on the Supreme Court is likely or possible. But Democrats obviously are crying foul, saying that this exposes McConnell's hypocrisy. You mentioned Merrick Garland back in 2016, where McConnell blocked his confirmation all throughout that presidential election year. And the gamble paid off for him, right? Because McConnell kept saying that the next president should fill the vacancy. Well, the next president turned out to be Donald Trump, a Republican. And so that gamble paid off enormously for McConnell. Democrats know that he's one of the savviest politicians on Capitol Hill. And, he will be looking to fill that vacancy should one occur with another conservative.
Do you expect to see whatever happens with appointments in the next year or so? Do you expect to see Supreme Court nominations be a big issue in the races, not just for president next year, but for the U.S. Senate?
I would agree. I think they probably will be, just like they were in the 2016 election. That was one of the central arguments for Republicans about why Donald Trump should be elected president over Hillary Clinton, the Supreme Court, that he would have an opportunity to put conservative judges in those slots, and he has so far. And so McConnell can certainly point to his record of filling some of those vacancies with conservatives, not just on the Supreme Court, but all of the federal courts. And there have been dozens and dozens of appointments that Donald Trump has made. And so I think that will certainly be a central argument for McConnell as he defends his very narrow Senate majority.
And most recently, Scott, we're, of course, watching the news of Hurricane Dorian. It hit the Bahamas, now threatening the U.S. East Coast. What kind of things are people in the nation's capital talking about, if at all, when it comes to the hurricane?
Well, the hurricane obviously is on everyone's minds as we've seen the images from the Bahamas, and now it's making its way to the United States. In terms of policy, it has disrupted it's disrupted Congress's return to Washington. The Judiciary Committee, headed by Democrat Jerry Nadler, had hoped to bring his committee back to Washington today, in fact, to hold hearings and mark up some legislation on gun reforms to sort of keep driving home the point that gun reforms are needed and to put pressure on Mitch McConnell and President Trump. Well, that was scrapped because of the hurricane, because a lot of his members are based out of Florida and the East Coast, some of those East Coast states. And so, unfortunately, for Nadler, he had to scrap his plans. And now, Congress is not slated to return until next week. after a very lengthy six-week recess.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. He joined us to talk about this week's news out of Washington. You can still let us know what you think about the Trump administration moving money meant for military construction projects to build at least part of a southern border wall. Is this where we should be moving our money to? Do other parts of the immigration system need funding more? If you're a supporter of the president's plan to build a wall, do you think it should take priority over some of these other issues? Let us know. Email ideas at WPR.org. And you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Have you ever been annoyed by someone at work or at home who wouldn't stop whistling? If so, I'm sorry, it might have been me, but I mostly have it under control now. But to be fair, I'm only a so-so kind of whistler. Not like the people who gathered just over a week ago near Los Angeles for the Masters of Musical Whistling International Festival and Competition. As reported in the Christian Science Monitor, whistlers from around the world gathered for classes, workshops, demonstrations, and competitions. While whistling has been a hobby or habit for people for a long time, the internet has helped a whistling community come together and share music and create get-togethers like this one. I have a theory about annoying whistling that I do. The whistler can hear what they're trying to whistle in their head. And, you know, it kind of smooths out the flat notes or the, you know, monotone whistling that they're actually doing. And in their head, they hear the beautiful melody. The whistle-y, the people listening, hear the actual audio be created. They're not inside the whistler's head. They don't know what it's supposed to sound like, and it can just get really annoying. Well, back to the competition. The big winner was Akiko Shibata of Japan, who took the prize with her rendition of Under the Sea from The Little Mermaid. Couldn't find her performance of that song, but here's a little sample of her whistling in action that I found online. This is Central Time.